Hello and welcome back to the Land and Climate podcast. My name is Bertie Harrison-Brudinski, and today I'm talking to Steve Trent, CEO of the Environmental Justice Foundation, about fishing. We're discussing international fishing regulation, which has wide-ranging implications for climate and environmental issues, as well as human rights. The European Union has had some success in tackling illegal fishing since EJF began working on this issue 2 decades ago, and the upcoming forced labour regulation could have further impact. But not all countries are trending in a positive direction. Thailand, a major exporter of fishery products, is threatening to walk back reforms made in the 2010s following a recent change in government, even as marine ecosystems are still recovering from historic overfishing.
They were being used as slaves. We documented clear stories, clear witness testimony of people being bought and sold. 59% of people on board those Thai fishing vessels had witnessed a murder of a colleague.
I began by asking Steve for some background into issues in the fishing sector and why they have always been a focus of his organisation's work.
There are some very high-profile concerns that go on in the environment movement where you have a host of organisations doing a great job. And we wanted to tackle those issues that were under the radar. And when we set the organisation up 2 decades and a bit ago, relatively very few people were talking about fisheries. Yet if you look at fisheries on a global scale, fundamentally important for food security in the larger part of the world, a massive export business that was bringing in huge revenues throughout the supply chain, both at point of capture and at point of sale, maybe in a supermarket in a Western country, a multitude of other areas where it had real impact. So you could talk about livelihoods and the well-being of different communities in very poor countries. You can also talk about the importance of our ocean and its marine biodiversity. And fisheries, commercial industrial fisheries in particular, have been for a long time causing real damage. So if you care about food security or if you care about climate, fisheries does actually matter. Many people talk about the Amazon as the lungs of the earth, which is actual scientific nonsense. The true fact is it's our ocean that provides over half of our atmospheric oxygen and takes in most of the anthropogenic carbon dioxide. So you want to look after it. You want to have effective stewardship. And nowhere has that been less seen and less effectively delivered, that stewardship, than in global fisheries, where it's been a free-for-all. I think the biggest reason why they've been ignored is simply because you can't see them. Most people's experience of fisheries is a fish supper, whereas the reality that happens on the water is very, very different. You know, these are large-scale industrial operations. If you take something like bottom trawling, that's been quite eloquently described as the equivalent of clear-cutting the seabed, when you get large nets that are dragged over the ocean bottom, taking everything with it. Whereas not so long ago, the seabed was considered by many to be almost dead, you know, a blank space. We now know that it is full of life, hugely important, both in terms of biodiversity, but also the carbon cycle. And so we need to look at fisheries in the context of its impact on climate, as well as we need to look at it through a human rights lens and a conservation lens. It touches on all three extensively, and it is very important in all three.
An acronym people are likely to come across when reading about these issues is IUU, or illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing. Could you explain what people mean by that? Is there a legal or internationally accepted definition of what's included within that category, or does it vary?
So IUU fishing. The illegal is fairly simple. It's where people are taking fish in areas that it's prohibited. They're using nets that have been banned either by national jurisdictions or maybe by regional agreements. That's quite simple. It's the unregulated and unreported. And they are more complex, but still you can keep it simple. The unregulated is where they're fishing commonly in the high seas, that vast area of our global ocean that is not really regulated by anything or anyone. And that can take a multitude of different forms. So they're just not reporting the fish that they catch, they're misreporting the fish that they catch, those kind of things. The Unreported, again, it touches on the same themes. And the reason why those two points, the unregulated and the unreported, are so important is because they can amount to vast volumes of fish, and they can be taken in areas where you have ecological fragility, where you have decline or possibly even collapse of fisheries. You can have legal fisheries that are totally unsustainable. So it's not just a simple, broad brushstroke definition. It does cover a whole heap of sins, but it doesn't cover everything. The term obviously is recognised around the world, but there are different views on it. And ultimately, outside of the high seas, in coastal waters, where vast volumes of fish are taken, the bulk of fisheries actually exist, then it depends on national jurisdiction, national legislation, what is illegal, what is unregulated, and what is unreported.
And so for the same reason, would it be that fish that may not be IUU, in terms of how it was produced, could still have the same human rights or environmental issues in some places, depending on their local laws?
Yeah, this is where the IUU regulation of the European Union was so important, because effectively it was saying, here is a set of rules, here is a policy framework, here are the guidelines that we should abide by. And then it took it a dramatic step further. It exported those ideas by saying to third countries, if you do not follow these rules, we may first warn you under so-called yellow card, and then if you continue not to make amends for abuses as we see them, we may leverage a red card and ban your product from the European Union marketplace. Some people might say, so what? But when you understand that the EU marketplace was the most valuable marketplace for fisheries products in the world by value, it's a big deal. And many, many, many third countries wanted to export their products to the European Union to earn hard foreign cash. It's simple as that. So really important piece of policy development there, policy framework there from the EU, and world leading. It's never been done before. And as we look back over the history of the regulation, you know, you've now got a decade or so of this regulation in place. You can see that it's had real impact. It has been leveraged. It has been used. And in some instances, it's been used to great effect.
Could you give us one of those instances where it's been successful, and maybe talk us through another where it hasn't?
I can. It's a very simple one, one that maybe some of your listeners will have seen before because it was so widely covered in the media, and it focuses on Thailand. If you scroll back to 2010, 2011, Thailand had a fishery that I think by many, most all international experts, and in fact by their own admission, was out of control. It was genuinely the wild, wild east. You had over 50,000 mechanized vessels that were fishing despite local laws in a free-for-all. There was no implementation and enforcement. There was no monitoring, control or surveillance. And within the Thai seafood sector, you had an interesting set of circumstances coming together. You had an economy in Thailand that was booming and virtually full employment. You had neighbouring states like Myanmar and Laos and Cambodia that were relatively very poor, where people were seeking higher value employment and jobs. And you had the exodus from the Thai seafood industry of Thais because it's tough. People didn't want to work on those boats or in the industry. That led to large scale trafficking of individuals in from those third countries to Thailand. And that was one of the critical pressure points. Once they were trafficked in, they tended to be vulnerable, often not speaking Thai, not knowing what was going on, being without documentation, being without protection. Commonly, they were then trafficked into land-based facilities for fish processing. But the worst of it was when they were trafficked onto boats, Thai fishing vessels. And within this industry, you had somewhere between 600,000 to 800,000 workers. So you're talking a lot of people, 51,000 vessels or thereabouts, Thai vessels on the water in this free-for-all. We documented people spending not months at sea without pay, often without adequate food, often without any kind of support at all for years, and they were being used as slaves. We documented clear stories, clear witness testimony of people being bought and sold. So not just trafficked onto one vessel, but sold onto another vessel. To give you an example, 2014, in a variety of surveys done by the UN, ILO and others, we found that 94% of workers on those fishing vessels had no contract at all. 80% reported never feeling free, 68% reported sexual or physical violence. And perhaps the most dramatic figure was that which emerged from a UN survey, which told us that 59% of people on board those Thai fishing vessels had witnessed a murder of a colleague. That's what was going on. Why was this happening? Well, within that wild, wild east, within that crazy system of no control, the Thais had managed to fish down. So most of their fisheries were in collapse. We saw a decline in what's called catch per unit effort of around 82% in over two decades. So for the same amount of effort, you were only catching 15, 16% of what you used to catch. Huge downward economic pressure to reduce costs. How can you do it on a boat? You can't really get rid of your marine diesel. You can't use cheaper nets. You're having to stay out at sea longer because there's fewer fish. You can't find them. The only real way you could do it was on crew cost. So they used these people coming in from neighbouring states, vulnerable individuals, as slaves and forced bonded labour. That's how they did it. And there was a whole system of violence. And I choose my words carefully because I think this was systemic, that emerged across the Thai fishing sector and powerful individuals involved. We did an investigation with something called the Department of Special Investigation, a team from the Royal Thai Police. We went to a particular province, Kantang, where we'd been investigating an individual. And with them, it led to arrests, not least of one person who had been chairman of the Police Oversight Committee, the former mayor, the head of the Fisheries Association, a powerful individual, his own personal fiefdom in this arena. And he was subsequently convicted of human trafficking, slavery, and violent abuse, including murder. You can see this was not kind of speculation or conjecture from NGOs, organisations like mine. It was verified under judicial scrutiny across the country. So enter the EU. They are aware of this and they're made increasingly aware of this. They're taking large volumes of Thai seafood into the European market, and they engage in a bilateral discussion. It doesn't work particularly well, and they end up leveraging a so-called yellow card, which is not just an economic threat, if you like, because they do have an extensive process of bilateral engagement, really trying to help Thailand do it. But it was also a huge smear on brand Thailand. This country, this leading, developing, fast-developing Eastern economy, very sophisticated in many different ways, was being told by the European Union, you can't even control your own fisheries, and we're letting the world know it. At the same time, the United States were listing them under something called their trafficking persons report on their lowest tier because of the same reasons, because of the trafficking of people, not least into the seafood sector. That led to an extensive dialogue between EU and Thailand, and cutting a long story short, they rewrote their entire legal framework. They then worked with us, among others, among many others, to implement it and enforce it. And as everyone will know, any law is only as good as its enforcement. So we worked through the systems. They started by, for example, having portside measures to make sure that the people that got on the boats were A, legally allowed to get on, weren't being bought and sold, coerced, but also that they got off them at the other end, so they weren't being murdered at sea and pushed over the side. We worked with them to provide really simple systems. Instead of using fingerprints, if you've ever seen a fisherman's hands, you know that they don't really have fingerprints, so they couldn't work out why they weren't able to follow their paper trails. We worked with them just to use iPads, get retinal scans, and it was simple. We conducted multiple operations with the Royal Thai Police at sea, using an undercover vessel called Poseidon that would launch high-speed ribs to catch the illegal guys in the act, so to speak. And over a period of a number of years, I'm not saying it became a perfect, beautiful world, but it transformed the industry. That extensive use of murder was no longer happening. The massive use, the overwhelming number of fishers being force bonded or slave labor, that didn't exist anymore. That they got rid of that. The fact that they were actually making sure that their vessels were catching fish in areas where it's legal to fish, and so on and so on, vessel tracking mechanisms. It was transformative. I'd rarely in 30 years seen such a big change. It was the European Union and that IUU regulation, that piece of law that they introduced that made those changes possible. That was the most important driving force. That's where it's worked well. In other areas, they have not been so successful. For example, in Vietnam, a nearby state to Thailand, where you have extensive illegal fishing, you have all sorts of problems, probably less of the violence and human trafficking, but still massive illegal fishing. And the Vietnamese don't seem to want to listen very much. They're not acting. The EU went and red carded them and prohibited their export. They said, excuse me, we'll sell to the wider region and China in particular. We don't care, almost.
And in Thailand and other countries where it has been successful, I mean, we're talking about, what, less than a decade, really. Have you seen a bounce back in ecosystems as well as with the human rights issues?
We have, and this is the really interesting thing. So we saw catch per unit effort already over a relatively short period of time. You know, I'm talking 2, 3, 4 years. You could see catch per unit effort increasing. You could also see the diversity of catch increasing, but you would see the size and the age of the fish increasing. Now, that's critical because when you're catching juveniles only, you know you've reached the bottom of the barrel, basically. As you start to have more mature individuals in your catch, A, you're getting a better product. I mean, it's as simple as that. It's easier to sell. But B, it tells you that the fishery is maybe not glowing, but it's recovering. So fundamentally important for the marine biodiversity, for the environmental issues, fundamentally important on the human rights issues. The EU IUU regulation only applies to the environmental piece. It doesn't have any caveats or provision for the human rights abuses, but the impact on that area as well was profound. I can see, you know, there's few other areas where this happens. Obviously, the US Trafficking in Persons Act can be a reputational smear. It can have other impact. You have things like the Lacey Act in the US that maybe you could compare sort of to the IUU regulation. There's also something very obscure that most people don't know about called the Pelly Amendment to the 1967 Fishermen's Act, which gives the president discretion, executive powers to apply sanctions on third-party countries for undermining multilateral environmental agreements. It's only ever been used in an executive way once, and I was participant to that, and that was to threaten China with sanctions and to actually impose sanctions on Taiwan for their trade in ivory and rhino horn. That was rare, and that was years ago. I can't even remember when we 1996. So you can see in this world of multilateral regulation, the EU IUU reg is highly unusual and a really important piece of legislation. And I would say, as the EU legislation across a multitude of issues, forests, wetlands, maybe other food and agricultural produce, as they're promulgating new regulations, new laws, we are encouraging them strongly to look at and learn from the lessons of the IUU regulation, because there are some powerfully important messages in what has taken place over the past 10 years or more.
And I want to come on to the forced labour regulation that's been discussed in the EU. But just to return to Thailand before then, I know that you and EJF are concerned about apparent reversals that may be due to take place in Thailand. Are they just about the human rights issues, or are they about the environmental issues too?
Yeah, both the human rights and the environmental piece. What I think about all the time is, how do you drive change that's durable? It's a bit of a glib phrase, but durable across political transition, across economic shock and time. And it's a really critical thing, because you can see organizations laying claim to great changes and great success. And that may be true, but all too often, they're just not durable. And this is our fear for Thailand. There's been an election. You have a new government there. And one of the first measures that they have undertaken is a review of the fisheries laws that were introduced in response to the EU action. And cutting a long story short, it seems clear that there is significant or substantial intent to repeal those laws. And the fundamental facts are that they're looking at the monitoring, control and surveillance elements, the bits that actually make the law functional as much as anything else. So by removing monitoring, how do you know what's going on at sea? By removing some of the checks and balances and controls that meant as you looked in on the sustainability piece, you could also see the human rights piece. That is going to go dark again very largely. And so we won't know, they won't know. And I was recently in Bangkok. It's fair to say I've had extensive dialogue over the years. You know, I've met with the leadership, the deputy prime ministers on a dozen or so times. I've met with our principal interlocutor, used to be the commander-in-chief of the Navy. We've worked extensively with the enforcement agencies. And the words that people in those sectors are telling us now is already, just because it's being discussed, there's an unraveling taking place quietly. And some of the enforcement measures that were keeping people safe, that were ensuring sustainability and legality, are melting away. And that's the fear. Now, if you get the repeal of the laws, or the substantial amendment of the laws, rather, it does seem like we will be back to the bad old days. And, you know, talking to a colleague, and, you know, I think the phrasing, you know, was at worst, this will be a human traffickers charter and a rule book for the return of IUU. At its best, it will be a weakening of the laws. But either way, it's a lose.
What is your reading of why that political change is happening in Thailand?
Of course, when the EU leveraged the card and then engaged in the bilateral dialogue, there is a feeling of, who are you coming over here telling us what to do? It wasn't intended that way, but you can see how that thought pattern emerges. The second one, which is peculiar to Thai politics, when I was meeting, you know, the prime ministers and people in Thailand repeatedly again and again, the unfortunate reality was they were an unelected military junta. This doesn't sit comfortably with anyone, didn't sit comfortably with me, but they happened to be in power. So they were the people that imposed these new laws. You have now had an election. And for all its flaws, you do not have the junta in control anymore. So I think there's been a pushback there. There are also powerful interests. There's something called NFAT, the National Fisheries Association of Thailand, a small group of industrial fishing owners. And I want to stress, this is not the small artisanal fisher who depends on this, but industrial fishing owners who have been vociferous throughout. Would like to see me in stocks, I'm sure, if not worse. And they have argued the case again and again and again, and they have an outsized influence, an outsized voice, not dissimilar to those that we see in UK or France or across Europe. And the last point is there's an individual. He's one of those powerful individuals in Thai politics. I can't speculate on the precise motivations, but we do know that he is pushing this agenda forcefully and vociferously. And that we need to cut through his background noise, and hopefully the elected leaders in Thailand will see reason.
Are there gaps that you see this new regulation going through the EU filling? Do you think that it can succeed where the IUU regulation failed?
So you have this ongoing debate within civil society and, of course, within among the legislators about, at what point do you create something that looks wonderful on paper but actually becomes unenforceable? And what burden do you really want to put on business and industry across Europe? Burden that might lead to, for example, the loss of your job or mine, ultimately. And I think those are really reasonable questions. So at the moment, I think what we have with the forced labour regulation is something that is good. I'm not going to say the best or the friendly strong, but on a global landscape, it's very good. Within the European context, it's good. Global landscape, it's very good. It's not through, it's not home yet. And for those who are watching with care and attention, they will have witnessed last week German federal ministers coming out and saying, we don't like this. We're not going to do this. Whispering words and mutterings about it. And that's coming from, remember, Herr Schulz and a centre-left green government. So this is not a right-left thing. That's them saying, hey, we're not sure we want to place this burden on German industry. We're calling that out. We think the current formulation of the regulation, as I mentioned, whilst not being perfect, is good. It's strong. It is enforceable. It is implementable. It would actually protect European industry, businesses, jobs without just simply being a piece of a technical barrier to trade or a tariff mechanism to exclude others and set up walls.
Any more insight or analysis on why Germany is pushing back on the forced labour regulation? Is there a particular sector that they're concerned about?
I think the concern in the context of German industry and the architecture of German industry, where you have, sure, you've got the giants, the BMWs, the VWs, but you also have that whole host of large-scale family-run businesses. And I think they are electorally extremely important. And they're wary of applying levels of regulation which those companies would feel onerous or difficult to abide by. I think it's as simple as that. I think it's the hard numbers. But I would say, you know, our message back to them was don't roll back on this. You will win in the long run. And Germany is very well placed to ensure that it actually gets economic benefit from this rather than cost.
The other one was, when you've been studying or engaging with this forced labour regulation process, has phishing been part of that conversation from officials? Have you seen this being discussed? Because, I mean, we've done a few podcasts before on similar issues about other sectors. A lot of what I've read in the past few years about forced labour has been about China. I haven't really seen as much about phishing.
Is phishing a big part of the dialogue? No, we've tried to push it, not least because of the functionality of the regulation. We wanted to see, for example, a carding process, because we didn't want to have a simple binary choice presented to decision takers where you're going to ban or allow products onto European marketplace. And we felt that the carding process was an elegant mechanism to engage in third-party dialogue and give a warning so you didn't suddenly turn the tap off or on. And I think that's, in the real world, I think that's profoundly important, because the laws of unintended consequences, you turn the tap off on a Bangladeshi cotton production, for example, you're going to see young women and girls ending up as prostitutes in urban centres as a result. There's no easy, wonderful, beautiful ways through this. So we pushed the IUU regulation, we've tried to insert it in there, but I think the truth is, across most policymakers, they're just not interested in fisheries. And so you have to shout pretty loudly to get that in there.
My thanks to Steve Trent for coming on the show, and to Vasco Kostovsky for our audio engineering. If you enjoyed this episode, we'll put further reading in the podcast blurb, and you can find more articles and podcasts on our website at www.landclimate.org, including an article by Steve about fishing regulation. Please do follow, subscribe, and leave a review on whatever podcast platform you use. We really appreciate it. And then we'll see you again in 2 weeks with a new interview. Until then, goodbye, and thanks for listening.